Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, May 21st, 2015. Many topics to cover tonight. First of all, I just slays me when I see this. I was watching on the weather.com, and they have these explanations of weather. So this guy comes on, and it's so embarrassing to watch this. I mean, I'm embarrassed for these people that have to read this tripe. But anyway, the explanation they give for tornadoes on the leading side of a hurricane as it makes landfall is that the hurricane comes on land. The friction of the ground, they said, causes the wind along the ground to retard. That causes an upwelling and a swirling of air, which then in turn causes tornadoes. And I'm like, oh my goodness, the friction along the ground. I mean, I just want to recount another thing. One time I was watching also the Weather Channel, and there was a hurricane coming into the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. And this guy is on there, and he's saying that the mountains of Yucatan are retarding the winds in the hurricane. And I'm thinking, the mountains of Yucatan, Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico is one of the flattest places on the planet. It has an elevation maybe of 5 feet over the entire peninsula. So the mountains of Yucatan were stopping and retarding this tornado, or I mean hurricane. Unbelievable. But at any rate, a couple topics quickly. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. But Amazon, I had a little tussle with Amazon.com this week. They have vendors on there selling my books as new. And I've attempted to go through the normal channels. Google has a copyright infringement group. And I've attempted to get my books removed from Amazon. I don't sell on Amazon. I don't have any secondary vendors or third-party vendors, whatever they call them. I don't sell wholesale. I only sell retail on my own webpage, and that's why. From the very beginning, I realized that I had caught people printing my books. The very original Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes book caught a woman in Texas printing a book and selling it. I mean, these people have no conscience. So anyway, I've got into this tussle with Amazon over removing these authors and my products, which are my products, they're copyrighted. And so and Amazon basically refuses. What I'm starting to realize is many of these third-party vendors at Amazon, and a full 40% of Amazon's profits come from these third-party vendors. It's the most profitable part of their business. But it's becoming obvious to me that Amazon itself is loading up the all kinds of products, from everything from they're famous for selling phony Nutra-Medical. Nutrition and medical pharmaceutical. That's what they're most famous for. And also things like chargers for your cell phone or battery or cell phone cases, etc. Knockoffs that are, and they're very deceptively labeled. Now, Amazon could easily clean this up in a day, but they don't because it's highly profitable. So anyway, the short story here is that do not buy anything of mine on Amazon. I do not sell on Amazon. I don't have any secondary sellers. In fact, they're selling, in some cases as used, 2003 versions of my books. And so, I mean, it's just very strange. But then in the investigation, when I was looking up trying to determine the level of problem in it, this is a huge problem. There are fraud and fraudulent agencies who go after fraudulent companies. Amazon is the most the widest selling counterfeit vendor, or through them, because they're not really the vendors. But what I'm saying is, in a lot of cases, they may be the vendors. In fact, what the vendors do is they, once they're closed down, if they're closed down, they quick jump to another one. A lot of these people have four or five sleeper accounts that are sitting there waiting to be jumped into as soon as one is closed down, if they're closed down. So Amazon has a huge problem. A large percentage of what they sell is counterfeit, and by these second source vendors. I'm not going to go into any more than that, other than do not buy my books. If you did buy a book on Amazon that has one of my books or anything, send it back, because it's a knockoff. It's a unauthorized vendor. Send it back. Get your money back, and please buy from my own webpage. But also what I found out is that the CIA and the NSA paid Amazon, now this is the known amount, $8 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars to Amazon to build a private communications cloud, a network, that would then allow agencies, possibly like your local police force or the state or county, other agencies, investigatory agencies, etc., to tap into the CIA NSA databases. And this looks very shady, as remember that Facebook was acquired by the CIA, Google was acquired by the CIA. They are amassing unbelievable amounts of data on people. What better place to amass data than on Amazon.com? And so, anyway, I just wanted to report that. I don't want to waste a lot of show time, but this is really the drug laundering money of the CIA is so extensive and so pervasive that it touches the fabric of our entire society. There is not a shred of our society that is not touched by it. I talked in John Moore's show last week about the tremendous number of break-ins in the cities these days, and these are primarily drug addicts, heroin, cocaine, and crack cocaine. These people's bodies are shot. They cannot manage. They can't hold a job. They're completely destroyed people. Yet the only thing they can do is steal to support their very expensive drug habit. And so this is a direct result, once again, of the CIA drug program. You know, the ill effects on society of keeping those drug prices up, keeping these people addicted, the police forces, the court systems can't keep up with it, so they just dump these people back out on the street, and the next day they're robbing and getting their daily fix. Okay, moving onwards. Just a quick note on my end of the world sale. It's going to end Sunday night, and that's because I'm moving into some different marketing aspects, but I wanted everybody to get a chance to get in on these super low prices. Not everything is priced way down, but the main water filters, the water filter elements, the 10 packs, that is, of water filter elements, the good ones, the GFs. I shouldn't say the good ones. The other ones are just as good. It's just that they don't take out all of the add-on. You need an add-on filter for the regular filter elements. But the end of the world sale on my webpage will end Sunday night at midnight. And also I have a new book coming out. It's should be hitting the streets here shortly. And I think this is going to be something that's going to be wildly popular. My Wing Generator book has not been a giant seller, but it never was intended to be. It's for a very specific audience interested in alternative energy. Once again, the webpage, JMCC, JM is in Mary, CC, S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo.com, the seven letters JMCC, SCI.com. This past week, 1.1 million people in Sri Lanka affected by high winds, flooding, landslides, untold number dead, a direct result of the storm systems that moved around the world this past week. And I made an explanation for what had happened. The solar flare that came by Earth, it missed Earth, and then about a day later, we started seeing this unbelievable storm activity all over Earth. The typhoon, super typhoon Dolphin in the Pacific crossed Guam and raised into a super typhoon. although, by the way, they were underreporting, this was an underreported storm, in that the winds were not super typhoon strength, even though I don't know why they were reporting it as a super typhoon. It did not have super typhoon winds. It had gusts up to 100 miles an hour. But still, it's a fairly significant storm. We had tornadoes across the entire United States. Africa had unbelievable storm systems. Indonesia, Malaysia, across the Indian Ocean, across, like I say, Africa, tremendous thunderstorms all across Africa. All a result of this, but there were other factors involved. We are right now in a very direct electrical alignment with the planet Saturn. Saturn has a very significant discharge of the solar capacitor out far in the solar system. Of course, it's way beyond Jupiter. But this solar flare and a new moon passing connected, the combination of these factors caused this severe weather. So at any rate, the National Weather Service did not predict this. They don't understand why this weather is going on. All they can tell you is after the fact. But I want to also say that by May 30th, we will have a full moon, and this flare will be moving out towards Saturn. It could be that on May 30th we could have some serious activity. But the other thing is I think this flare has kind of fizzled out as it moved out beyond Mars in the solar system. And so my prediction for May 30th is very tentative. I don't know if anything significant will happen. Just as I analyzed the annual hurricane season, and there's very little going on this year. On August 16th, we have a Venus-Earth alignment and a new moon passing. So that could be a new moon passing is my definition. 2 days after the new moon, when the new moon passes out from in front of the Earth, between Earth and the Sun, that is a trigger point for severe weather systems. And that sudden change, when all of a sudden the moon stops blocking the solar wind and all of a sudden moves out of the way, that solar wind comes pounding in 250,000 miles. Our geomagnetic field is typically only about 30,000 miles out in front of us on the sunward side. And so that impulse coming in can compress our geomagnetic field and the plasma geomagnetic field and trigger severe storms down on Earth. So at any rate, that's the August 16th date, and then September 29th, we have a Mercury-Earth alignment with a full moon. There again, it's a date when something could happen, especially if there's other effects, comets, etc., in the solar system. But not really, you know, it's not enough to write home about. It's not a big deal. It's one of those combinations that could result if some other factors kick in. Just a quick announcement, the Larsen B ice shelf in the news again. It's been crumbling over the last 10 years. It's been crumbling into the ocean. They expect it to be completely gone by the year 2020. What's left right now is about the size of the state of Rhode Island. And, of course, it's claimed that global warming, because of you driving your SUV up and down the road, is the cause of this. Simply what's going on is the Earth is stabilizing after the Venus event of a number of thousands of years ago. Global warming, yes, I explain this in my weather book, that the Earth's weather is in fact warming. All right, in the news, and this is something I'm very interested in seeing come through, and I hope NASA releases photos, and they're not going to sit on these and Photoshop them to death before we get to see them. But I suspect that's actually going to happen. They did this with Mercury. They did it recently with the Ceres mission, the Dawn mission to the minor planet Ceres. They were hiding data, sitting on it, and then photoshopping it and toning it out, toning out the good stuff, let's put it that way. What would obviously be electrical discharge tracks across Ceres. But the New Horizons spacecraft arriving at Pluto, what I still consider to be a planet, Pluto, July 14th is the expected flyby date, so very much awaiting that with bated breath. And I'm very anxious to see Pluto, because Pluto doesn't fit the bill. It's way out. It's by far the farthest planet in the solar system. When you look back from Pluto and see the sun, it looks like a very dim flashlight on a foggy day. So there's no solar energy arriving at Pluto, and Pluto is small. There's a minimal cross-section. So very minimal sunlight arriving at Pluto. So, but we already know that it has an active atmosphere. So in a normal 4.5 billion year scenario, Pluto should not have an atmosphere. It should have lost it, or it should have crystallized and simply fallen to the ground. So this indicates to me that we're going to see some new-like features on the planet Pluto. Plus, it has 5 known moons. Chandra, I should say, 1,100-kilometer diameter moon, is about half the size of Pluto. So it's really a twin planet. Then we have 4 other known moons: Styx, Nix, Kerleros, and Hydra. And so these are all names, mythological names from Greek mythology. But 4 other little moons, all in a very nice planar orbit around the planet Pluto. So this is going to be interesting, because some of these moons may have associated rings, and it'd be interesting to see which ones do and which ones don't. But the reason they would have rings is the same reason as the inner moon Io of Jupiter, where Io draws in sulfur dioxide from the region around Jupiter and acts like a comet. It's discharging the local capacitor of Jupiter, which is caused by the fact that Jupiter is a small star. It has a fusion process going on. It has a proton wind, which was measured. This is not me talking. This was measured by the Voyager spacecraft. They saw that the proton wind coming up off the, and I don't call it the planet Jupiter, I call it this small unlit star Jupiter. And so at any rate, it's very possible that Pluto, some of its moons will have rings in the same kind of situation where they are discharging the local capacitor. Now, Pluto is way out there in what we call the Kuiper Belt, where many small planets form. And I have talked about this before. In that region where the nebular ion cloud is, that's a region that's ionized a nebular gas and dust cloud held back by solar wind, the excess current of protons in the solar wind. And so this is a positively charged region, and it's a good place for negatively charged planets that are discharging the solar capacitor. Very good, rich region for them to grow. And so Pluto is a what you might call a Kuiper Belt object, and gaining mass, gaining atmosphere, etc. So it would be real interesting to see, for example, volcanoes on Pluto. There's no indication at this point that there are, but Pluto does have surface structure. They have seen this with the Hubble Space Telescope. So anyway, time will tell, but we may see some electrical discharge phenomena, cometary-type phenomenon for both the moons and for Pluto itself. So all of this would be very interesting, and once again, I suspect that NASA will be photoshopping the goodness out of anything released. But, okay, so more on that. That's something I'm going to be tracking more in every show from now on. This is the New Horizon spacecraft arriving at Pluto July 14th. A thing called sprites in the news. Now, this is not the gas, the carbonated beverage. These are electrical phenomena that occur above thunderstorms. And there's actually a season for this. It corresponds with the Northern Hemisphere tornado and hurricane season and aurora season. This is the beginning of the aurora season. We're just beginning the hurricane season, etc., which runs through November. And of course, the reason for this is because centralized in August, at the center of this time period, is when we pass through the return current sheet that comes back from the far distant region of the solar system. And I made an association this week to something that some people might be familiar with. They're called riptide currents. Now, a riptide is when waves are coming in to the shoreline. And, of course, that water moving in has to go someplace. So what happens is it kind of bunches together, finds a weak spot, and then it flows out that one spot. Maybe every 50, 100 feet, every 200, maybe 100 yards, maybe every 200 yards along the shore, there are riptide currents. It's the number one cause of drownings, I believe, in the United States. I heard that statistics because people get caught in these and they try to swim to shore and they can't and they run out of energy and they drown. Of course, what you're supposed to do is swim sideways and get out of that rip current, and then you can swim into shore, float in with the waves, etc. But this is the same phenomena that happens with the solar wind. As the solar wind moves out and reaches that nebular ion cloud, it cannot keep doing this. It's like waves of protons, positively charged particles, that keep building up. But they want to get back towards the sun, and so there's a flow of current that comes back. And this happens to be where the Earth passes in the month of August. It's one of my discoveries. It's one of the things that I had to account for in this whole electrical circuit of the solar system. And then, of course, the solar capacitor, comets discharge it, the planets discharge it, etc. That's one of the main causes for Earth weather, is the discharge of the solar capacitor. So at any rate, the other factor here is that in summertime, our North Pole is pointed towards the sun. And so the northern hemisphere, it gets the benefit of that sunward electron current. As we discharge the solar capacitor, the electron current is tapping into Earth. And as the summertime occurs, as we start swinging around past spring, which of course was March 21st, approximately March 20th or 21st, after that, the North Polar region starts to point towards the sun. And so that means the Northern Hemisphere is getting the direct benefit of that electron stream that comes out from the sun as part of our overall discharge of the solar capacitor. So this is when the Northern Hemisphere sprite season starts. So during thunderstorms, there's a reason why we get sprites. We have thunderstorms that occur in spring. In fact, most thunderstorms occur in the early springtime. And in the late fall, we get our share of them also. But the sprites only occur just starting about now. And those people that observe them are just starting to observe them. And they typically observe from maybe 100, 200 miles away. They see a thunderstorm and then the lightning activity. They see it above the storm and then below the storm. And the standard scientific explanation is that this somehow forms in the cloud itself, and then electricity comes shooting out upwards. Well, electricity is shooting out down below to the ground, too, in the form of lightning. This is part of the overall larger-scale electric discharge of the ionospheric capacitor between the ionosphere and ground. And so, anyway, that's my explanation. That's the real explanation. And as I've said before, clouds of themselves have very little electric field inside. They're basically a conductor with very little electric field inside. Now, the sprites consist of gamma rays, and as I reported a week ago, they have now measured positrons in clouds that are associated with high-energy lightning. But in the cloud, the electric fields are zero. So what's going on? Well, this is based on the fact that the cloud is a discharge point because of the vertical electric field. And the cloud is like basically a conductor. So the electricity discharges down along the path of the clouds. And by the way, going back to this explanation of why there's tornadoes when a hurricane makes landfall, it's electrically discharging to ground. That's the first point it gets, as I explain in my weather book. The hurricane itself forms because the ground air, or the surface air on the top of the water, is ionized, and it follows the electrical circuit up the eye of the hurricane, swirls up as it is swooped up on the electric field. That's the discharge of the vertical field, electric field. And this is the source of energy for the hurricane, that electrical discharge. It also causes the hurricane to move westerly as those ions move up the column. Right-hand rule of current working in the Earth's magnetic field pushes that hurricane westerly. So that's why hurricanes move to the west. It's an electromagnetic effect of hurricanes, of the electrical current. But as the clouds move in and the front edge of the cloud, which is where the majority of the electrical charge is flowing, as that reaches landfall, the discharges start occurring, and those are what cause the tornadoes. It's not friction of the wind moving along the ground and then causing tumultuous activity like you hear on the Weather Channel. The silly science out there is so ridiculous, simple Simon, silly science, that somehow hurricanes have friction as they make landfall. Gee, these people are so lame. It's just pathetic. And don't you think it's ironic you have these people that are paid, probably the guy doing that little lecture is probably paid $80,000 to $100,000 a year. Maybe more, maybe $150,000, $160,000 a year. These agencies are paid billions per year to give you the weather, and they have no clue what causes the weather. I just see this over and over. I'm not going to waste more time on that. A topic, red rain. Now, this is something that's been going on for some time. It's very poorly reported, and it's becoming more widely reported now. Red rain, and there are various types. You see a type of red rain, it's actually like a pink rain, a soft, it's almost like you took a flower petal and ground it up very fine and threw it in the water. It's kind of like that organic. And they say that this is due to cells, but they have very unusual properties. They're not based on DNA. Some people believe that these cells come from outer space. Some people, well, they don't know where they come from, but some people are saying these are from outer space. So it's very interesting that some form of organic life cells are forming in outer space and coming in and dropping down into our rain systems. I've pointed out before that a lot of the rain that comes into the atmosphere is not coming from the oceans, not from evaporation of oceans. We just saw a case here in California where the rain was starting to fall east of California, but it didn't rain in California. Now, you can see in the satellite data, you can see the water vapor in the air. I mean, there's one of the readings that you can get from any of the satellite, remote satellite viewing of the planet Earth. You can see the moisture content, the vapor content, and water content in the atmosphere. Crossing California did rain a little bit, but then it started to accumulate tremendous amounts of moisture in the air east of California. And it's like this water is coming from out of the atmosphere. I pointed this out. There was a storm that formed in Duluth, Minnesota, a number of years ago. And I reported on this. It was perfectly dry all the way across the plain states. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, here's this cloud that forms, dumps, 12 inches of rain in 12 hours. Unbelievable amount of water came down, destroyed the city. It was washing, it was literally washing the street and the houses away. Just torrential rain for 12 hours. Destroyed the infrastructure of the city. And where did that water come from? That water came from outer space. There was no, in the weather systems moving across the United States, there was absolutely no moisture content at all. But back to the red rain. So it looks like some of the red rain is caused by cells, biological cells of some kind that come from outer space. But there is more than one type of red rain. Some of them are blood red. Some of them are this faint, pinky, very diluted-looking red rain. But the blood red rain is seriously red, and they once again they speculate that this could come from dust that blows in from a nearby desert or something like that. But then they also note that these things are measured, and they literally cannot detect any dust or whatever earthbound material. And all of a sudden, here it is raining red rain in a certain place. So the end result is that the jury is still out on this. Nobody really knows what causes red rain. People are studying this. There's individuals who have gone to study this. There are agencies. There are governments funding studies of this. And really, there's no end result on this. So it's something I'm going to track along with my million other things that I track is red rain. And we'll keep reporting on that. I'd like to get off to do some of this myself. And like I said on my webpage, I need to clone myself about five times to get the manpower that I need to do all of the things that I want to do. But red rain is a good one, because I remember that I reported that from Jupiter, we can, the ancients talk about this when the comet Venus came by, the red rains, the sulfur dioxide where it came in, it looked like, they call it the red hand of death. And in that Moses picture of the film back from the 1950s with Charlton Heston, a great movie, some of the best visual effects given what Hollywood had available at the time, wonderful effects of the pillar of fire, of the burning bush, for example, the bush that burned but was not consumed, obviously an electrical fire from an electrical discharge. And then the red rain, the blood rain that filled all the rivers, etc., with blood. And that's where the sulfur dioxide comes in, because the comet, a big comet, is going to connect out to Jupiter. And as that dust, that sulfur dioxide dust comes in, settles into the upper atmosphere as it connects in, would spread out and then start dropping down in fingers. And in that movie, by the way, is a very wonderful animation of that effect. So if you have that movie, go watch it again. And but at any rate, this topic of red rain is something you have to, in fact, I'll make a note here right now and follow that topic in the future. Just one observation is that the official government agencies that are studying this in the various countries where it occurs do not want to talk about any extraterrestrial source. They feign away from that. They're looking desperately for some earthbound, and then they don't want to talk about what the other private agencies are talking about. They're saying, hey, this comes from outer space. There is no earth-borne source for this red cellular material, etc. So anyway, okay, changing gears just a little bit. Students need quiet time, hours and hours of quiet time. No radio, no television, no video games, no interruptions, no company coming in and saying, do you want a drink of soda pop? Nothing. You need absolute hours and hours of quiet time. Brothers and sisters, whatever it is, you need quiet time. And this is not optional. Your brain cannot function when it's being tripped with outside input all the time. You need quiet time. When I was young, I had the benefit of having my own room, and I had a great big desk that my dad had gotten for me at a workplace. It was a huge wooden desk, and it had a great big rack, of kind of book rack above it. My room was up in the far end of the house, the second floor, far end, and it was perfectly quiet. And so I had hours and hours of study time to do math, physics, my subjects. And, you know, this is very necessary. Something that's really been lost today in the modern world with a million interruptions at all times. So students, you need, and parents of students, you need to provide them with a quiet place to study and give them that time, you know, and no TV, no video games, etc. If not, you're going to have mediocre students, and the world is going to have people with very much first-level thinking. The people in charge of this world want kids with constant interruptions, constant diversion, because it takes their train of thought. They say the average television program, the train of thought necessary to comprehend what's going on is no more than 15 seconds. In other words, there's no carryover from one 15-second segment into the next 15-second segment. And you pop back and forth between various scenes, but it controls your mind with input from outside. In other words, the mind loses control to guide itself. Let me take a complex mathematics problem. In just regular undergraduate, or if you get up to graduate, they even get more complicated. Some problems take months of work to understand just what the problem is saying. For example, the Riemann hypothesis, that's a good example where literally the experts agree that you have to study it for about a year before you even understand what the problem is, let alone understanding the various methods of solution, etc., which is, of course, one of the unsolved problems in mathematics. Okay, well, enough said on that, but you need quiet time, you need your mind to work, just say a typical undergraduate physics problem can take an hour, hour and a half to really draw the pictures. I always drew pictures so I'd understand what the mathematics was saying and relate to the real world. And a lot of people would just, I can get the answer, here's the equation, okay, end of the story, and they think they understand it. No. There's a whole level of understanding equations, how it relates to the real world, etc. So, anyway, people, you need a lot of time. You need a lot of more time than what people are putting into mathematics and physics, and that's why the Western world is failing miserably when it comes to science, because they don't have the time. There's too many interruptions, etc. Okay, enough of that. But parents, and especially I notice the Amish, for example, are great in that they keep their kids away from computers. One of the biggest diversions, one of the things that keeps us all diverted, answering those emails, those text messages constantly. Kids are constantly confronted with just interruption, and their brains cannot function more than 15 seconds at a time. How are you going to have beyond first level thinking? How are you going to have a public that understands scientific concepts? How are you going to have a public that can understand? I had this come in this week. A listener writes in and says that, Velikovsky proved that planet X comes every 3,600 years. And I'm like, oh my goodness, these people can't be real. Velikovsky's story said that the comet Venus became the planet Venus. So it became a planet. How is it supposed to come back in 3,600 years? This is so lame. How can people actually put this on paper and not realize that it doesn't make sense? And that's what I'm saying about first level thinking. The internet is so full of misinformation, and they depend on people not being able to see through that first layer of garbage. Okay, so on to the main science topic. As you all know, every show I try to put in half of the show or at least 20 minutes on a given scientific topic that is relevant. And now that we have the New Horizon spacecraft, it's approaching a few months away from the very short time. July 14th is going to be here before you know it, in arriving at the planet Pluto. And so what to expect? I mean, what's going on out there? This is in a region of the solar system they call the Kuiper region. And it's simply, Kuiper was an astronomer who has his name tagged on that, so that's the term Kuiper. But really, what's going on out there? They're finding more and more planets out there all the time. There's an official list of 40 planets, of some of them bigger than Pluto. Sedna, the other ones. Sedna goes way, 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 way out on an elliptical orbit, and it was actually discovered at its closest point to the Sun, even though that was a couple times farther than the planet Pluto. So Sedna was one of the first ones, and then they started in earnest looking out there with automated telescope searches to find these objects. And so they're estimating, based on the amount of sky that they've covered in the automated search and based on the amount of sky that is out there, and the fact that they're not always going to see these things. They're very hard to see. Some of them would be very dim. Pluto was discovered, the Tomlinson discovery, back in the, early 1900s. I'm sorry, his name was Tombaugh, and they discovered in, 1930, the planet Pluto. They had been looking for this thing for quite a long time because they realized that the motion of the planets Uranus and Neptune did not fit the scheme of things. There was something pulling on them or whatever, so they had projected another planet. But anyway, now they're with automated search telescopes, they are discovering more and more. Remember the announcement? I made a big deal about that both on my homepage and on my radio show, that astronomers had recently announced that they had at least two, not one, but two large planet X-type objects that they were expecting to find, and this was because of clumping of small objects out there. They didn't actually discover the big objects, but they said that they were on track to discovering at least two large Planet X-type objects, and they called them Planet X. But now that doesn't mean they're going to come into the inner solar system and destroy Earth. Remember that there are many, many Planet X objects, and this is something I've been saying all along, so they literally confirmed everything that I've been telling you. This is standard science. And so, let me go through some details about what's going on out there. Standard science, of course, has no explanation for where these objects come from, because their standard explanation says that all the planets formed at one time, 4.5 billion years ago, from this swirling gas and dust cloud. And then, so they say, well, these must have been thrown out there. Well, if they were thrown out there, then they'd be on elliptical orbits that would bring them back into the inner solar system. They don't just get thrown out and somehow obtain a new orbit magically out there. No, they would come back in the solar system on that same elliptical orbit that they were thrown out. And so, anyway, literally the standard scientific community has no explanation for what's going on at all. But here is what is going on. Now, we can look at other stars and see what I call the nebular ion cloud. Standard science or astronomy calls these nebular clouds. The term nebular ion cloud is something I coined. They actually call them planetary nebula. So I suppose it's because it's somewhere out in the distant region away from the star. But you can see these around every star. Every star that we see has one of these regions around it. And also our own star, the Sun, has a region like this. And by the way, that is what the cosmic background radiation, that's what they're reading. They're reading the microwave heat signature off of that nebular ion cloud, which the standard science does not recognize. They don't understand it, etc. But at any rate, going back to the concept of the solar wind, I talked earlier in the show how the positively charged solar wind, excess of current of protons, and that word current is very important in there because current has various properties. It has the charge, and then it has the velocity of the charge. So the protons move faster, and they're moving out in the solar wind just like in the case of the Van de Graaff generator, the electrons move outwards to charge up the outside bell of the Van de Graaff. And they continue moving out there. Even though the Van de Graaff bell is negatively charged, those electrons continue moving out there. And it's the same principle. A lot of space scientists do not understand this concept, but it's something I developed in my early work back in the 1970s to account for the fact that we were observing these electrical discharges of the solar capacitor in the form of comets. And so anyway, I had to propose and then verify that there was in fact an excess current of protons in the solar wind. When Jupiter was being studied by the Voyager spacecraft, there was a proton wind that was sensed by the Voyager spacecraft coming up off of Jupiter and then later at Saturn. Both of these support proton winds coming off up the planet, and that's because they have low levels of fusion going on there. And so one of my other discoveries was the discovery of basically cold fusion, that it is ignited by energetic lightning bolts in the atmosphere, and it's a nuclear fire supported by fire. And one of the end results is the separation of charge. And the structure is that the surface, the subsurface of the object, which is either Jupiter, Saturn, or the Sun, is positively charged. But around that, and we actually see this around the Sun, is a corona of electrons, relativistic electrons that are spinning around, caught in the electric field of the Sun, the positive electric field. So you have the electrons spinning around, and that gives the overall charge of the Sun as being negative, because the protons, when they come blasting out of the solar atmosphere, the electrons are retarded and the protons are accelerated towards that electron cloud, the corona, and connect magnetically, open up holes, and that's where the solar wind comes, but they're primarily protons. The electrons are retarded, and that's why the protons have excess velocity in the solar wind, and that's the explanation. Standard science has absolutely no explanation for the cause of solar flaring, for the surface flaring on the Sun, for the cause of the solar wind. They don't have a single explanation at all. They can't tell you why there are relativistic electrons orbiting the Sun in the corona. They can't tell you any of this. I'm not going to dwell on that. But okay, so the end result is this nebular ion cloud, which we see around every star, which we detect as the microwave background radiation around our own star. And that's not due to the Big Bang. It's due to the fact that we're seeing the heat signature off this nebular ion cloud. It changes with time. And that's another thing that they've discovered with the IRIS satellite. When they first put it up there, they measured a map of what they considered the Big Bang heat signature, microwave background radiation. 3 years later, it changed. It was changing shape. The intensity of certain areas was changing, some augmenting, some diminishing. And that's due to the fact that the nebular ion cloud is dynamic and it's close. It's not some kind of heat signature at the beginning of the universe, which would be very stationary over extreme long periods of time, certainly millions, possibly hundreds of millions of years stable without change. And so once again, proving that what they're looking at is nothing more than the heat signature of the nebular ion cloud. Okay, so back to that. That's being held back by the solar wind. And so this is kind of, when you see it, I have pictures in my books. I have pictures on the my posters, for example. Take a look at my posters. And they have pictures of a star. One is the Eskimo Nebula, which I believe is in the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. And it's a kind of this cloud. It's like a donut-shaped cloud hovering around the star. It's being held back by solar wind pressure. Okay, well, that's if material falls in, it's harbored there. It kind of stays there. It can't fall in because the solar wind is pushing out. But also, the solar wind sweeps out a good deal of material that's in the inner solar system and holds it out there also. So this is a very rich area of chemicals, of all of the atomic and chemistry of the solar system being held out there, plus dust and gases, hydrocarbons, nitrogen, oxygen compounds, nitrogen, hydrogen compounds. Everything is out there. So I wouldn't be surprised if we find, for example, Pluto to have a very rich organic atmosphere. And its moons. And this is something that would be very unusual, is to find atmospheres around the moons, because they're very small and they don't have enough gravitational field to hold an atmosphere for very long. So to find atmospheres around the moons of Pluto would be another major confirmation of my theoretical work. And NASA can only keep the lid on these photos so long, and they're going to have to admit it and go, well, gee, this doesn't fit with our standard model either. Why should a moon, a very small moon, maybe 100 or 200 kilometers across, moon of Pluto way out there have an atmosphere? It doesn't make any sense unless you understand my model that these are new moons, newly captured, relatively new, and plus they're sustaining, they're discharging the solar capacitor out there, they're drawing in this material, gases and dust from the nebular ion cloud, which is a very rich region for supplying these planets and moons with new material. And so that is a region in which the material is, I would say there's a high likelihood, a very high percentage likelihood that one or more of the moons of Pluto is going to have an atmosphere. And so that would just blow standard science completely out of the water with any explanation. But of course, they can always fudge something. Somebody in some back room at NASA will flip out of the back pocket some theory. It'll get published, and that'll be the standard explanation. That's how silly science happens. Okay, so at any rate, I'm not going to dwell on that. But okay, so now we have these objects. They're orbiting all kinds of orbits out there. There could be objects out there, Planet X-type objects, that have come into the solar system. There could be objects that came, 100 million years ago, 200, a billion years ago, and they're not going to come back for, they could come in at any moment, or they could come back in 1,000 or 100,000 or a million years. We don't know. We don't have a history on this. NASA themselves said that they have discovered about 0.1% of the objects that are out there. Just based on statistics, if you cover a certain area of time and space, and you can only see so far, and you've discovered so many objects, this gives you a statistical basis for understanding how many objects are out there. And so based on that, there could be thousands, tens of thousands of objects out there. Now, why are they out there? Well, because a chunk of rock or material came in from who knows where, could have been captured into this region, or just mildly drifting by, was captured by our sun's gravitational field, started drifting through this region, discharging the local solar capacitor, building up mass and dragging it by the mass, the tail drag, basically, of the comets that these would form, by dragging them into this solar region of the Kuiper Belt and start developing small planets. So we could have, even though it's not like there's a fixed number right now and it can never be added to, it's an area that's very rich that is probably constantly being added to. And as these objects spiral in, as they gain mass, and that's part of the discharge of the solar capacitor, the negatively charged planet draws in the positively charged dust, ions, gases, etc., builds up mass, and that slows it down in its orbit, drops it into a lower orbit. So these objects are continually spiraling inwards. Something that, now let's look at, for example, the outer planets, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. All have moons, and there's something like 27 of the moons of Saturn which are known to be captured. They don't fit into the nice plane around Saturn, prograde orbits, etc. So NASA already has had to admit that at least 27 of the moons of Saturn have been captured. That's what I said all along. Comet capture is the formation of solar system. That's the title of my book that was printed 1979 when I was at Cornell. That's the basis, that was kind of the fundamental basis of which my other papers were published, the galaxy paper, the Saturn sweeper moons paper, and then the three-part comet paper, etc. So at any rate, let's look out in the Kuiper area. You have a very rich resource of dust and gas, And also these dust and gases would tend to be positively charged, because remember, the unabated solar radiation coming out from the sun, ultraviolet light, X-rays, etc., would be ionizing this material, bumping an electron off so that they would be ionized, making them fertile ground, even more fertile ground, to be drawn into any of the objects out there. As those objects discharge the local solar capacitor, they charge negatively, and so it's like a vacuum cleaner drawing in gases, dust, whatever, and so they makes it a very rich area to grow. That's why the Kuiper objects are in the region out beyond Pluto. That's the reason, because they're moving through that very rich nebular ion cloud, much more abundant in species of dust and gases and chemical species and molecular species and atomic species, much more abundant even than the inner solar system. And so these objects move very slowly because they're very far from the sun. And we're going to have, in fact, this would be something. Let's take a 10-year-old young man or young woman out there listening to this radio show. When you grow up and you get your degree in science, etc., someday you might be at the forefront of telescopes that are maybe a dozen or 20 or 50 telescopes that are much better than what we have today for focusing on that region and doing complete mapping of all of these minor planets that are out there, some very large Planet X objects. In fact, you might be discovering Planet X objects that would come into the inner solar system and eventually have an interaction with the inner planets. So, but remember one thing, NASA actually built a telescope a number of years ago. It was designed to detect infrared clouds moving. Let's say that a big object comes in through the Kuiper Belt region, through that nebular ion cloud, what's it going to do? It's going to discharge the local capacitor. It's going to surround itself with a dust cloud, and the only signature, you're not going to really be able to see the object itself because any minor amount of sunlight would be blocked. And the end result is that the only way you can detect it is this big moving ion cloud, very difficult to detect with the background of the nebular ion cloud. So there's people say, well, Planet X, it would be huge and we'd see it. Well, no, you wouldn't. In fact, Hale-Bopp was not discovered until it was almost into the inner, it was out around the orbit of Saturn, I believe, when it was actually discovered. But I'm out of time. I just want to remind you to go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, 7 letters, and go to the webpage. The end of the world sale ends Sunday night, and hopefully by then also I will have my new book release out. It will be in an ebook format, and I think it's a topic that's going to strike home with the wide-scale general public. So at any rate, more on that. Keep tuned. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.